This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring interviews with two writers who are brothers and have each written memoirs about their family. Jeffrey Wolfe and Tobias Wolfe grew up separately after their parents divorced. Tobias, who we heard from earlier, went with their mother. Jeffrey stayed with their father. Jeffrey thought his father was a Yale-educated man of refinement. But he later learned his father was really a con man who made up his credentials and his lineage. Jeffrey's memoir about his father, The Duke of Deception, was republished earlier this year. I spoke with him in 1990, and he told me about the man his father pretended to be.
My father represented himself as a very well-educated man, and I mean, so well-educated that he represented himself as having a degree in aeronautical engineering from the Sorbonne, which is, of course, a school of the humanities, has no aeronautical engineering degree anyway. His ambition in the beginning, I believe, was to impress his father, who was a surgeon and very hard to impress. And then he tried to impress others, and the process of trying to impress others was always self-aggrandizement. He claimed to have been a war hero, for example, in ways that were awfully hard to reconcile, because he claimed to have parachuted in among the Yugoslav partisans at about the same time he was flying with the Flying Tigers over Burma. His process always was engorgement. I mean, he had huge appetites, and he was a person who said, just a little bit too much is just enough for me, for example. He was, I suppose, what you'd call clinically a psychopath, in the sense that he seemed to have no moral conscience. He'd write bad checks in a restaurant, but he always tipped in cash. He knew how to take care of the help. He was immensely charming. He was witty. He was well-read. He was very quick. He was very smart. He was very warm. He was a crook, and he spent the last years of his life in prison.
But when you were growing up, you didn't know any of this.
No. When I was growing up, he was a hero, and I idolized him, and I idolized him probably for the right reasons. I idolized him because of his warmth and his wit and his unfailing attention to me. He was a very loving man. He had many friends. And so the particulars of his curriculum vitae were all unknown to me, and at that time of no interest to me. So in an odd way, I could say that I had a happy childhood, except when he was away, which was a lot of the time.
How did the masks get taken off?
Well, a lot of them get taken off when a son or a friend begins to become acute enough to see that things aren't matching up, that they don't make any sense. He got caught. Well, he rose to the august position of assistant chief engineer at Boeing. At the time, they were building the XB-52. And because he had to have atomic clearance for that, it was after the war, it was in, I think, 1949, 1950, he got caught by the FBI. And the FBI traced back all his job resumes. And job resumes were okay. They tracked back. He'd worked for North America, and he'd worked for Northrop. But all of a sudden, they tracked him back to the Sorbonne, that all of that monkey shines with the Sorbonne and the Yale and Groton, and he hadn't even been born where he said he was born. He liked the idea of having been born in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York. So at about the year 1937, which was a rather potent year, he fell off the face of the earth to the FBI, and I'm here to tell you they were very upset by that.
So did you learn about this through the FBI?
I learned some of it when the FBI came to visit our house in Seattle. And I remember how nice they were. I mean, how kind and gentle they were, the FBI agents. In fact, they told me that they'd like me to leave the room, and they were extremely polite, courteous to my father. And when they left, for the first time I saw him deeply shaken. But at the same time, you know, by then, the circumstances of our life had been so erratic. We'd lived high life and low. We'd lived in horrible rooming houses and in antebellum mansions. We had lived off the cuff. We had lived in the Ritz-Carlton, and we'd lived in a cold water walk up in Niagara Falls. We'd lived all over the place. So by the time this happened, and I was 14 years old, I didn't know what to expect anymore, ever. And that seemed all natural to me, because we take the extraordinary in our lives almost for granted in an odd way. I think all children do that.
Did you ever talk to your father and confront him with the truth of his identity?
I did it twice in particular. The first time, I will never forget, I'd grown up with the last name that I have, Wolf, and as it happens, my father's father was a Jew, and my father's mother was a Jew. As it happens, my father's father was a Jewish atheist. My father represented himself as an Episcopalian and absolutely denied his Jewishness, so he absolutely denied mine as well. And at a time when I was at the Choate School, I'd spent some time looking in the mirror. And I said, "Boy, that certainly looks like a Jewish boy to me that I'm looking in the mirror at." And I remember asking my father for about the third time, I said, "Am I Jewish?" And I remember him becoming extremely exasperated, in a very calculated and in a very effective manner. And he said, "For God's sake," he said, "you know me. Am I an anti-Semite?" And I said, "No, you're not an anti-Semite." And he said, "Then why in the world would I lie about being a Jew? Why in the world would I lie about such a thing?" And at that moment, my choices were binary. I either had to disbelieve him about everything that I knew, or I had to believe him. And it was a horrible and unforgivable thing that he did to me that day. And, of course, I won't forget it. The other time I confronted him is by writing a novel called Bad Debts, in which I wrote what turned out to be a cartoon version of him, a kind of a caricature version of a con man. And I sent him that book shortly before he died. At the same time, he was stone broke. He'd just gotten out of prison. He had some Social Security, and he was getting checks from me every month. And after he read that book, Bad Debts, he stopped cashing the checks, which is the most extraordinary thing of all the extraordinary things I know about him.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with Jeffrey Wolfe. His memoir about his father is called The Duke of Deception. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Jeffrey Wolfe. Let's bring up the subject of your brother, Tobias Wolfe, who is also a writer now. And when your parents separated, he went with his mother, you went with your father. And as you were growing up, sometimes living the high life, sometimes living the low life, he was growing up in a near broke atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to come east, where you were living, to get away from his mother's abusive lover. He wanted to go to a boarding school and was hoping that you would help to get him in. And you did. I was wondering if you ever gave him advice on how to behave in a more middle class kind of environment, the kind of environment he was about to enter.
Oh, poor baby, did I give him advice? Oh, did I give him advice? I gave him advice till it came out his ears. And that advice now, I mean, he and I spend a lot of time laughing at that advice. I taught him manners, but I also, I remember we had this extraordinary summer together in La Jolla, California. My father had a nervous breakdown. He was in a mental hospital, in fact, and my brother and I hadn't seen each other for, I think it was almost 12 years, and it was just before he went to the Hill School, and I just graduated from Princeton, and And he didn't have a job. He was a little kid. He was 15. And so I was supporting us at the time. And I remember every day before I went off to work, I'd make him read a book, a whole book, and write an essay about it. Every day. I mean, I had this absolute power over him. And I exercised it. But he wrote for that summer every single day an essay, and every single day he read one of the great books that I assigned to him. And it was a horrible abuse of power on my part, but at the same time I don't regret it now for a moment, and I'm not sure he does either.
You know, I'm sure a lot of people see you and your brother almost as this peculiar science experiment. What happens if two brothers are separated, live in completely different kinds of environments, in different social and economic classes, and then meet as young adults, you know? And now you both ended up as writers. You both ended up writing memoirs about growing up and about growing up with your parents or with your parent. it's really kind of remarkable. And I wonder how much you think is genetic.
Well, I don't know how much is genetic. He finds it less remarkable than I do. As a matter of fact, we had a conversation about this issue this morning. We talk almost, I suppose we talk 3 or 4 times a week, and we spend most of our time laughing. But we were talking about this very question: how remarkable is it that we both write? And he finds it utterly unremarkable. He said, "It's as unremarkable as saying two people have blonde hair, for example." I find it remarkable. So here we divide on it. Because he can't imagine, as I can't imagine, doing anything other than what we do, he can't find anything remarkable in it, I think.
What surprised you most when you read your brother's memoir about growing up, this boy's life?
I'd always known he was smart. I didn't know that he was a genius. It's an extraordinary book. In an odd way, I found myself reading his book and forgetting he was my brother. He became a character apart from me. I mean, a character with absolute integrity. Part of it, of course, was extremely sad. Part of it was scarifying to me to see how unhappy he had been at times. But after I'd finished the book, I realized that what he had done in his book was a thing I'd tried to do in my book too, was he had brought back alive and intact the whole complexity of what we call an unhappy childhood, that it isn't just monolithically unhappy, that it's complicated, very complicated, that there are parts of it that aren't unhappy at all. There are parts of it that are characterized by laughter and by singing and by friendships and by love and affection. And there isn't such a thing, or at least in my experience, and I think I can say in his, as a childhood that is simply unhappy.
Since you and your brother are pretty close now and you're both writers, are there ever territorial concerns over who owns a certain story that you share?
I think there have been in the past. That's ancient history, and it's also comic history. That's the kind of thing we wind up laughing about. There used to be a time, for example, when I'd call him and tell him a story, and I'd say, "You can't use this. This is mine." And sometimes he'd do the same thing. We don't do that anymore because we don't have to. Also, we don't tell stories like that anymore in print. In other words, the neat anecdote, the joke, or something doesn't find itself into print quite as frequently as it used to in the bad old days with us. But the subject of who owns what now is a subject of high comedy, or I should say low comedy for us.
Do you feel that you're very good now at telling who lies, at spotting someone who is a con themselves?
Sure, but I used to be obsessed with lying. I used to be obsessed with lying and the truth, and I don't care about it so much anymore. I have two sons, and when I first when they were first growing up, I used to tell them horribly. It's sort of enjoin them always to tell me the truth, son, never lie to me. Quite solemn about it. And of course they didn't. I mean, they lie the way all kids do about all kinds of things that they don't think I should know, and they're absolutely right, I shouldn't know them. And so I've got a good laissez-faire attitude toward the whole thing now. But can I spot a phony? I think yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and about writing. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Geoffrey Wolfe recorded in 1990. A new edition of his memoir, The Duke of Deception, was published this year. His next book, Age of Conquest, will be published in February. This is Fresh Air.